I don't know. I kind of like it.
Once again, it's time to open your ears and expand your mind. Or maybe it's dull your mind. Either way, I think these boys have something to say. So sit back, grab a brew. We're going to have some too. And give you our point of view here on Talkin' Brap.
Yeah, I do too.
All in all, I like it. I just like that guitar riff. I don't know. It kind of fits. Got the right attitude. Well, welcome back. It's Talkin' Brap episode 5. It's me and Mike tonight.
Howdy.
It's been a little break, man. I did a podcast convention, a family vacation. We started the busy season. We've had a lot going on, so we didn't get one out last beginning of this month like we wanted to, but hey, we keep moving on and do what we got to do. So
yeah. Aaron's moving and
yeah
he's got all kinds of stuff going on.
Yeah, he's knee deep in a move in a house. But the topic of the night is racing. We kind of talked racing last time because I had gone to the flat track, which was an awesome experience. So, in the meantime, I went to the drag races in, well, I guess it's called Union City, Goodlettsville, whatever it is there just outside of Nashville. It's called Music City Raceway. Very cool time. Reminded me of pretty much every drag racing venue I've ever been to, which is a lot of fun. You know, they line up, they hot lap, and it seemed like they did cars for about 20, 30 minutes, and then they do bikes for 20 or 30 minutes or so and kind of run back and forth. The local dealership here, one of our competitors, is kind of hosting the whole thing there first Tuesday of the month, and there was a lot of bikes out there, a lot of Harleys, a lot of cool stuff going on, side-by-sides, four-wheelers, dirt bikes, you name it, they were out there. So, you know, it gets you pumped up, gets you ready to ride. You know, I've seen some sporties out there tearing up that track. And, you know, ultimately, I think the biggest takeaway if you go to one of these drag races, especially when they're all Harley, is that V-Rod is fast as shit, man.
Yeah, they are fast.
Holy cow. That if that is not set up for a drag strip, I don't really know many bikes that are. When they hook up with a little bit done to them, they were running, you know, mid 7 second, 8th miles down there all day long. There was a half a dozen of them out there running that, you know.
Well, we were kind of talking about that people don't understand how different V-Rods are
than
regular Harleys. I think the reason that they didn't do better domestically in sales is because the Harley ingrained sales culture didn't know how to sell the V-Rod.
Oh, yeah.
And they didn't embrace the different aspect of it, you know.
Well, you know, that in that same thought, I think that's kind of what made Harley where they're at right now and why they're kind of hurting is that last generation or so, they had no idea what to do with. And now they're realizing it, and that's why our ridership is going down a little bit. I think that V-Rod would have fit our generation of riders had it been marketed properly. Mm-hmm. The riding position is a little weird. It is not for what the typical Harley rider was when that bike came out. I think that person has changed a little bit since then. But for the most part, in the early 2000s, we were still bagger heavy, you know, those baby boomer type people. They wanted nothing to do with that bike, I think. And it's a shame because they're awesome. They even sound good, you know. They when they hook up, they go, you know. And if you just cruise around town in one of those, you know, neighborhoods and cities and stuff, you really don't get a feel for what that bike has to offer. You have to open that thing up. You know, you got to get it up in the RPMs. You got to get it out on the road. And when you can get into the power band on that thing, you find out real quick what it's about. And they are cool bikes. there was a turbo bagger out there. I think when it may have been one of his first times out looking the way he was running, because his first couple runs and his last couple runs that I watched were, he had a different mindset. You could see he was, you know, trying different RPMs, launching at things like that. So it looked like he was getting down in the low 7 seconds when it was all said and done, which was pretty quick. I mean, especially for a bagger. It was not the most impressive bike on the strip, though, for sure. And I bet he felt bad. There was, in fact, I put a video on the Instagram of a little Sportster running him down. I mean, damn near beat him. Damn near. And he left the light way ahead of him. I mean, he had him at 100 feet by a mile, it seemed like. And that Sportster damn near ran him down, and I was like, holy shit, you know, while I was watching it.
Was it the flame, the one we wanted to buy?
No, it wasn't that one, but that was another great story of the track. Again, I posted this on Instagram. We had a customer came in the weekend before the races, and it was the last weekend of the month, so everybody's willing to make a deal on the last day of the month, you know, and he came in and purchased this bike for really cheap. It was, what, a 90?
98. No, it was 91. It was a 91.
91, something like that, yeah. Sportster. It had crazy forward controls that were like 3 inches higher than normal forward controls. Had extended front end and apparently a bunch done to the motor that maybe we didn't realize, because he went out on the track and was just destroying it out there. That thing was fast. So he, when we were at the dealership, he said, he's like, the only reason I'm buying this is go take it out and put it on the track and have some fun with it.
And it was he came in, bike. He came in and offered money on that like 4 hours before Sam and I were going to just buy it and turn it into a flat track bike.
I know. That's what he said. Next time we're all just going to go in and buy
it. We're just doing it. We're not going to wait and talk about it. We've got the money set aside.
Oh, I got the bug, man. You don't even know all the stuff I want to do to my bike. So, you know, we're talking about drag racing. You know, I have an 883. It's basically stock. It's got slip-ons on it. That's it. And this is, for the most part, it's bracket racing. You know, you're running times, consistency. So there's no reason I can't run an 883 on the track. So the only downside to this is, and maybe we'll talk about this another time, is the spring plate inside of the clutch on a Sportster. If you don't know, it's meant to make the engagement of the clutch smoother from the factory. Works great on a bike that you're not beating the hell out of. I got 30,000 miles and I beat the hell out of mine. So I'm not putting it on a track with that in there because I know I'll probably blow it up. But that's all I'm doing. I'm going to put a clutch in that thing and we're going to see how consistent I can run out there. I'm certainly not going to be beating anybody really, I don't think, on time, but it could still be a lot of fun. And that's what, you know, that's really what it's all about. You know, there was a couple of other little Sportsters. I mean, guys on basically pretty stock bikes out there running. You know, there was a 250 dirt bike, some four-wheelers, side-by-sides, like I said. And I think everybody was just out there to have a good time. The rules and things didn't seem overly too complicated. I didn't see them freaking out about anything, so you know, I want to set my bike up for drags now, of course. I want to flat track and drag it, which there is a bike out there. I think I showed you a picture of it, Mike. It's I'm guessing it started life as either an 883 or 1200. And he's kind of done a XR kind of bike that he's made out of it with the tail section. And it's got XR badges on it and whatnot. But that thing was fast out on the track, and it was fast out on the flat track too. I'm guessing he's probably got like a SNS hooligan kit or something in it, you know, and it runs good, runs real good. I actually hit him up on Instagram and was like, dude, I love your bike. Cause it's pretty much what I'd like to do to mine, which is make it a real XR. Although he does not have the inverted forks. So that's the only downside. I'm hoping to do that to mine. We'll see how that works out. But I had a caller lined up for tonight, a guy I know, Kevin, who runs, I guess you'd say road racing, I guess you would call it, at the big actual tracks where they do track days, and he runs an XR1200 Harley, which is a rarity out there to have a Harley out on these things. So he's been running it for a couple of years now, and he's also got a KTM Super Duke that he runs in these races as well, you know, different classes, so he can run all day. He's got two bikes now. But I was hoping to get him on here and talk to him, and we'll maybe do an episode about that, kind of what it takes to get into that kind of stuff and, you know, what it's like being amateur, if you will, and trying to get out and race and have a good time, but not break the bank. Cause I think we all know it's not a cheap endeavor. We go along with the road racing and the drag racing and everything. And Mike, you've kind of touched on the, land speed type stuff yourself, correct?
Mm-hmm. I've raced out in Bonneville.
Yeah.
On a V-Rod.
I was going to say you have a V-Rod kind of set up for that, right?
Yep. I have a 07 Nyrod special that I had crashed and then bought back from the insurance company and kind of went in with my father-in-law. And we turned it into a land speed bike.
Nice.
And that's totally different.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's not the same setup. Everything, land speed and drag racing is pretty much like hill climb and flat track.
Yeah.
It's that far apart, you know, because you have your gear ratios are so tall because it's a 5 mile shot. So you go out on the salt and you get at your start line and there's two different classes. There's, I don't remember what they call, the streamers, streamline.
Oh yeah, streamliners. Yeah.
So there's regular and streamliner. So really it boils down to the difference is the streamliners can't start under their own power.
Okay.
So they have to be towed to start.
Yeah.
So they have a 10-mile track and they're measured for 2 miles. The standard class, which is everything that can start under its own power. So you're standing at the start line. There's a guy with a green flag. He drops the flag. Your feet have to come off the ground and the motorcycle starts going. If you push the motorcycle, you're disqualified.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So other than that, it's all just whatever class you run in based on displacement. The way I set up my V-Rod, I'm actually running in the same class as all the Hayabusas because it's the same engine displacement, and I added a fairing and an inverted front end, which took it out of the stock body class and put it into the fairing class. If I would have left the fairing and the front end off, I would have been running with more of like a traditional V-Rod class and some of the other naked street bikes.
Yeah.
But it's crazy, man. It's different.
So how often do they get to do stuff like that?
Well, I think worldwide, I think there's like 5 or 6 actual sanctioned tracks. I don't recall. I know in the U.S. there's Bonneville, Utah, which is the Salt Flats.
Yeah.
There's Mojave in California.
Okay.
And I don't know if there's any other ones. I know there's one in Australia that's a big one. And they're just kind of, because you have to have this vast amount of space to do it.
Yeah, nothing around you know, to break or kill or
You know, and I mean even when we're out there, you know, the track, they go out, so there's like the AMA sanctioned National Speed Week, and then there's what I raced in was Bubs Land Speed, which is Bubs was an exhaust manufacturer that he was super into racing, partnered with Reinhardt for a while, partnered with some other exhaust manufacturers, but then started his own classification because during National Speed Week, it's really difficult on a motorcycle because you have to compete with the cars. So really, you have people from all over the world that come here for a 4-day event, and everybody uses the same track because it's not like there's 9 different tracks out there.
Yeah.
It's real specific because of the speeds that they're doing and how long the tracks have to be. So you have to have a relatively flat plane for 5 miles on the short track. And I believe they call it the mountain track, is 10 miles long for the streamliners. Wow. So on the regular track, you start at the start line. You have 3 miles to get to speed. They measure you for 1 complete mile, and then you have a mile to stop. On the mountain track, you have 6 miles to get to speed. They measure you for 2, and then you have 3 miles to stop, I believe.
So is it like an average over that mile is what you get considered for, or
it's,
is it
it's your time
you hit?
It's the time. It's how long it takes from when you enter the measured mile to when you exit.
Okay.
They take however long that takes to get from point A to point B, that's your speed.
Okay.
So then what happens if you break a record, they radio at the end, you stop and you go to the all the way to the end of the track, and there's, you know, another official there, and they either wave you off the track or they say, you broke a record, now you need to go back and do it the other direction.
Oh.
You can't leave the track. Because if you break a world record, a speed record,
yeah,
it's a big deal.
I'm sure.
You know what I mean? So, yeah. I mean, it's not like hooligan, you know, where you just go sign up. I mean, it's scrutineering. It's the whole nine yards. So when you run out in whatever class you're in, if you break the record for your class, you go to the end, you turn around, you do it again. Then they take the average of the 2 times. If the average is faster than the previous record, you broke the record.
Oh, wow. So you got to do it twice.
Yeah. You got to do it back to back. And then the average of those 2 times is your actual speed.
Wow.
So then if that's the case, then you have to go immediately to scrutineering and take the motorcycle apart while an official watches. And then they measure it and make sure that you are actually in the class you signed up for.
Wow.
Yeah. It's crazy.
And I'm guessing if you fail that, you're done. And
you're done.
And
you're everything. They disqualify you.
Wow.
So I never, you know, our bike never broke any records because we're in a class with bikes that are, it's extremely hard to compete against.
I would imagine, especially against like a Hayabusa. I mean, those from the factory do damn near 200 miles an hour.
Well, so on the salt, it's more like riding on the beach.
Okay.
So if it does 200 miles an hour on the tarmac, it would probably do about 165, 170 on salt. So you think these guys that are going 220, 230 miles an hour on the salt flats, that's probably a 260, 270 mile an hour vehicle on a roadway.
Yeah.
But you just, there's no way to get it going that fast because runways aren't long enough.
I think most of us get to see that stuff on TV. And, you know, I look at that, you know, on TV and I see like the cracks and everything in there, and they look like they're damn near big enough you can stick your finger in. You know, the cracks in the salt bed and everything. And I just think, man, is that really safe to be running on? You know, I mean, I guess it's hard packed and whatnot. I mean, I've never been out there myself, but, you know, where did that kind of, I guess somebody rode out there one day on something and was like, hey, look at this. It's long and flat and we can go fast as shit.
Yeah.
You know, well, and it was like, oh, fuck it.
I think it started in the 1920s. We could probably look that up.
Yeah,
you know, like you, there's that show, The World Fastest Indian.
Yeah,
you know that's kind of what
that was, salt flat stuff.
That was Bonneville, Utah. And the track is pretty rough, and from year to year it's different because the weather, and I mean it rains all year. I mean it's not like they cover it up.
I mean it's a lake at some time each year, isn't it? I mean,
no, not really. I don't know if the water gets quite that high.
Yeah.
It used to be an ocean, and then everything, you know, it's basically just the salt bed that's left from an ancient ass ocean that settled in this valley. And, but it's a trip because you go out there and it looks like you're like on the Arctic plain.
Oh, wow. Because
everything is white.
All right. So this is interesting. I'm Wikipediaing, the Bonneville Salt Flats, and it says geologist Grove Carl Gilbert named the area after Benjamin Bonneville, a U.S. Army officer who explored the Intermountain West in the 1830s. In 1907, Bill Rochelle and 2 local businessmen tested the suitability of the salt for driving on by taking a Pierce arrow onto the surface of the flats. So they are accredited as the first people to take a vehicle out on the salt flats and run it. I mean, what do you think that thing topped out at, like 94?
Well, did they race it, or did they just drive around?
I don't really say.
I think they probably just drove around, and they were like, I wonder if we're going to fall through this stuff.
A railway line across the Bonneville Salt Plats was completed in 1910, making the first permanent crossing.
Yeah, and then they made the highway right next to it.
The first land speed record was set there in 1914 by Teddy Tetzler.
So it was 1914.
Yeah.
I knew it was way back in the day.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, and I'm sure I do, because it's going through. There's like a million movies that have been filmed out there.
Oh yeah,
and stuff
sure.
Like that. But yeah, I mean, you know, I love the saying, and I can't remember where I originally heard it, but it was, you know, the first race ever was right after the second car ever was made, or the second vehicle ever was made, because it's human nature. You know, you get two of the same thing,
right?
Oh, dude, let's see who wins. You know what I mean? So. Mm-hmm. After the third or fourth car was made, or whatever vehicle, I'm sure there was some kind of race involved. And that's kind of where I think it transfers into cars, pretty much anything, dirt bikes, you name it. Racing rules, man. You know, racing kind of drives everything to an extent. You know, people don't, for the most part, I guess there's different type of people, but people aren't out there driving Challenger or Charger RTs because they get good gas mileage and they're eco-friendly. They're doing it because, A, they're probably NASCAR fans, because that's who's usually driving the Dodge Chargers and Challengers, or B, because they're fast and they want to line up next to somebody else and they want to beat them. You know, I think everybody, you know, what was it, Fast and the Furious, I live my life a quarter mile at a time. Yeah, we all love to live our lives, you know, a quarter mile at a time. I always loved that line. It was so cheesy, but I think we'd all love to if we could, you know. And, you know, for our generation, I guess in the 90s, it was like kind of that Honda four banger craze that
not
took
for
off.
Me.
Yeah, see, and it was for me over in Florida. I was cheap, man. I could pick up a car for $2,000 or $3,000, do a grand worth of work to it, and make this quick little car that got 35 miles to the gallon, and I could drive it around and beat the hell out of it everywhere I went. They were fun.
I had a 1967 Dodge Coronet with a 440.
Nice. So you were getting like 4 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, but it didn't matter. Gas was 95 cents. Same as a pack of cigarettes. Yeah. Back in the day.
I remember saying I was going to quit when I think they went to $2 or $3.
Yeah, this is bullshit.
It is fucking bullshit. I'm quitting years later. I'm paying like $6 a pack.
That shit's crazy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, they're talking about putting a new gas tax, so gas is...
It's not expensive enough, you know, and it doesn't drive everything on the planet, so... They you know, a couple of cents on gas, and they make so much money. Because gas drives everything.
Yeah, but they misappropriate it. That's a different.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
a different discussion.
I think that's a different podcast.
Yeah, yeah. That's a totally different set of hosts.
But you know, I think it plays into the racing and all that kind of plays into what we do for a living. In that the performance motorcycle, even the performance bagger, if you will, is kind of what's it right now. You know, that I think this Milwaukee 8 motor kind of woke up people's eyes as to what you can do with a factory Harley motor. You know, the twin cams, we saw the same motor for years and years and years. So even when they got up into the 110s and 120s, it was the same shit. Nobody really cared, you know. But this Milwaukee 8 has come out. I think, you know, like you were talking about, we just did kind of the cam shootout thing. With a bolt-in cam, you're almost inch for inch, you're inch for horsepower.
You know,
you can take a 114 and throw a cam in it and damn near get 114 horsepower out of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's close. You know, you might have to do a little bit of other stuff, but it's close, you know.
And I think, you know,
and you're killing it on torque.
Right. And it, you know, there's that old adage, and you just see the arguments all the time about how, like, oh, well, you know, the BMW X12. 130 horsepower, but that's at 8,000 RPMs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's, you can't compare these different engine technologies. They all make very similar power.
Yeah.
They just make the power in different ways.
Well, even then, I would imagine you could probably find a horsepower cam that you could put that you're not going to get the torque numbers that we want to see. And you could probably get over 114 out of a cam bolt-in, I would imagine. mean, are there not some horsepower cams out there that are more so than torque? I mean, most of what we're looking at are horsepower, torque cams.
You can do that. I mean, you can put like some of the... Okay, so we're speaking about Harley-Davidsons, which are basically, you know, they're 45-degree external pushrod.
Yeah.
Cam-driven. You know, the cams are on the bottom, the rocker arms are on the tops, and they have, you know, a real traditional drivetrain. They're not like the R1s that are overhead cams. Yeah. You know what
well,
I mean?
They have longer stroke. They can't rev out as high.
Yeah. So it's a completely different technology. And yes, you can find a cam that will make really large horsepower numbers, but you're going to have to rev it to like 5,000 RPMs, yeah. which in the world, I mean, it's almost like comparing a diesel and a gasoline engine.
Well, you know, that it's taken, I think it's taken quite a few years to train Harley people into stop looking at the horsepower numbers
and to focus on torque. It's not done. It's not even started.
Yeah. I mean, but we've had a good response, and I've seen since I've been here and since you guys have done the YouTube videos and all that, I've seen a wider acceptance of forget about your number and look at your torque curve. You know, that torque curve means a lot more than your peak number. Your peak number doesn't mean shit. If you're peaking out at, you know, 120 foot-pounds of torque and you're not seeing it till 3,000 RPMs and you're only seeing it between 3 and 5, it's not a lot of usable power. But if you're starting at 110 at 2,000 RPMs and you carry at least 110 all the way across the power band, that bike's going to kill the other bike on the road.
Right.
You know, and that's one of the things that I think we've had to train the customers into. You give me one of those, a beer. Oh yeah, that's it.
I was like,
yeah, I'm pointing at it. You're like, I don't understand animated. What's going on.
Are we being attacked?
Yeah. What did I do? But you know, and I think the more people start to realize that, you're going to see I so bad want to see some of these bikes we've built go out to the track and see what they actually do on the track. You know, especially eighth mile, because eighth mile is like damn near all torque.
Oh yeah,
you're not getting into enough to be worried about horsepower. That's why the turbo bikes. That's why I said I think I was talking to Sam about it.
Because they have to spool.
A quarter mile, that turbo fucking bagger probably would have been killing everybody.
Because once it spools, then you're hitting 4,500, 5,000 RPMs right about that eighth mile mark, and now you're hitting 130 horsepower. So
yeah. Well, there was a boost out there, and I mean, let's face it, if you know what you're doing and you set a boost up right, those goddamn bikes are fast as shit. And there wasn't a bike out there that could have touched that thing. But he was, I'm going to say, all but wheelie bar built up. I mean, I could see the shift light and stuff that was blinding his face from a mile away. You know, the thing was set up, and it was fast. I forget what it was running. You know, something stupid like fives. I don't even know. But it was fast. And it was almost not worth watching, you know, because it was like, yeah, that thing's fast. Okay, cool. What else you got? And I had a lot of fun watching the regular bikes go. There was a Dyna. I want to say it was like a Street Bob, something like that. And had ape hangers and shit. And, man, he had a hard time keeping that front wheel on the ground. And he was running bikes down because he would launch. And, you know, the front wheel would come off the ground and he'd let off it. And then just run bikes down. I don't know what he had on there, but that thing was fast. And I was talking to Jordan. I said, man, we need to get Mike. Get his Dyna out there and run it. And Jordan says, yeah, that's a jockey shift. Is that really good for drag racing? And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
No, not
I was
an
like, eighth. That thing probably wouldn't be that great on the drag strip.
Not in an eighth mile. In a quarter mile.
Quarter mile, yeah. Yeah.
Aaron's not here to say anything about this. But so, you know, my little 95-inch super high compression motor, you know, he has that 107 fuel moto that he thought was like all the balls back in the day when he first got around us. And I remember the first time we went and rode, we're getting on the freeway and I was behind him and I was like, I know this guy is going to be like, see ya as soon as he gets the opportunity. So as soon as he got a clear shot, I downshifted, you know, got to like $4,000, and I saw him pull, and I just hammered it and pulled, and he looked back, and he had to look twice because, you know, I just built Roadies 103.
Yeah.
And he looked back and was extremely shocked that this 103 and this 95-inch motor were right behind him. Ass, yeah. While he had his 130-horsepower 107. It was pretty funny.
You know, that's one of the things I have to say has given me the greatest pleasure as a rider is, and it's the reason I ride small bikes, like an 883, is because if I can take somebody in a turn or, God forbid, in traffic and, you know, beat somebody, especially in a turn, because I'm pretty good in the turns, mm-hmm. I feel so much better than being on like a sporty that I spent $10,000 on. You know what I mean?
Right.
I used to do the same thing on my Kawasaki, and it handled a little better than my sporty, so I could get it down pretty low in the turns. And I, you know, those clover leaves getting on and off the highway, I don't know how many sport bikes I used to cut inside and pass and watch their faces as I go by, like, what the fuck? You know, because it was just a cruiser. It wasn't a sport bike. But, you know, that's part of the reason, like I said, that's why I don't mind riding into 883, because when I go ride with all these guys that have $10,000 in their motors and I'm right there behind them, you know, I'm not beating them, but they're not leaving me in the dust either, you know. And then afterwards they're like, you know, that thing's faster than I thought it would be. And I'm like, thank you.
Right. Yeah. It just depends on how you ride it.
I rode with a guy who was from Michigan. I met him in Sanford, Florida. We got a ride together. He was down there for a couple months. And he had a CBR XX. I don't know if you remember this bike. It was back in the mid-90s. It was an 1100. It was a precursor to the Hayabusas. Yes, it was the Blackbird. You're right. Awesome. This is on my list of bikes that I will own.
That was a V-twin, wasn't it?
I don't know. The RC51 was a V-twin. I don't think the Blackbird was a V-twin.
No, the V-twin was an inline. It was a inline four.
Yeah, the Blackbird I think was an inline, but it was like I said, it was a precursor to the Hayabusa 1300 and all that. And I think at the time it was one of the fastest bikes, you know, around. And I remember being a young teenager and, you know, putting that bike on my list of things I would own. And I will own one day because they're cool bikes. You know, they were fun to ride. But anyways, this guy had ridden this bike from Michigan all the way down to Florida. And he was shipping his stuff to each destination, UPS or whatever, and he would just ride. And he had taken like a 6 or 8 month sabbatical or whatever you want to call it and was just riding around the country. I was so jealous. But we went out one day and went for a ride. And, you know, this is an 1100 sport touring bike, you know. And I'm on a Kawasaki 750 Vulcan. And we went out just hammering the bikes one day. And we pulled up to our first stop. And he got off the bike and he looked at me and he says, "That bike is a shit ton faster than I thought it would be." And I laughed. I was like, dude, thank you. I was like, that's a hell of a compliment coming from a guy on a fucking 1100 sport touring bike.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, you know, and we had a great time. I still talk to him to this day. Every once in a while, you know, we'll message each other back. But, you know, it, really cool guy to ride with. We had a good time. We did like Leesburg Bike Fest and some other stuff. And, you know, had a good time. But, yeah, you should love running around with the guys on sport bikes because they're always, you know, they think they're the shit. You know, they're like, oh, I got a fucking R6. I'm a badass. Well, only if you know how to ride it.
Yeah.
You know, if you know how to ride it, yeah, you can be a badass because that's a badass bike. But I don't know that most of them really know how to ride it, at least in my experience. I guess the guys that do, you don't catch up with, so.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty much across the board. I think a lot of people, you know, most people are casual riders.
Yeah.
You know, and most people, they don't put their machines through the paces. They don't push it to what it'll do. You know, we did a cam test video a couple months ago, and we did a comp cam. And the comp cam had the highest horsepower and the highest torque of all the cams, but it was like super late. It was, I mean, right up damn near red line. I mean, it was a dog all the way through. And I don't know how many people I want that comp cam. And we're like, no, you don't. You do not want that comp cam because you are not on a track.
Part of that was that lope. I think in that video when they played the sound of that.
Yeah, we're not doing the sound yeah, of this one.
The lope was really nice on that comp cam.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, it had like 250 degrees of duration or something. It was insane. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, when it was like it was literally a race cam that got put in the mix with all of these really great bagger cams.
I was going to say, and you kind of figured that cam wanted a bigger motor behind
yeah,
it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that cam would do well with you know, these when you get into the formulation of engine building and purpose, you really have to kind of pay attention because you can spend a lot of money in the wrong spots because you're not actually assessing what you are truly trying to do with a vehicle. And I mean, this isn't just motorcycles. Yeah. I don't know how many car enthusiasts and hot rod enthusiasts, you know, they'll spend so much money on the wrong components because they don't understand that's not what they were trying to achieve. They get it all because so-and-so recommended it, but you know, so-and-so is a Grand Prix driver. So when you tell them that you have a Datsun 280Z and you like to ride around on the mountains, he thinks you've already got a small block Chevy in there, or you have, you know, you've got an upgraded motor and you're going to be going 80 miles an hour on 40 mile an hour turns. He doesn't realize you're going 35 miles an hour on 40 mile an hour turns. And you know, people don't explain that.
Yeah.
So you have to ask. I think, you know, some of these tuners and builders, you know, the good ones are real responsible in the lead up questions, because it doesn't matter how much money somebody spends. It, what matters is that when you deliver the product, you deliver what they're actually looking for. Yeah. And you're able to explain to them that you don't want the most horsepower out there.
Yeah.
And by the way, I have to put this out there. Horsepower isn't even real.
It's
okay. It never was.
It's a made up number.
I think someone from the American Dairy Association got together with somebody in the automotive marketing department and figured out how to market this horsepower thing, because it's a mathematical calculation.
So I remember reading about this, and I don't remember if it was MMI or what was it, but so the story was they took like all these different types of horses from like Shetland ponies up to like Clydesdales. Okay. And had them, it was, you know how they make the horses walk in the circle thing or whatever. So they did
the
this type
butter
of thing with, I believe, some weight. They'd put weight on them and seen how many times they could go around, whatever it was. And they came up with this, I believe it's like 33,000 pounds per minute or something weird like that. And that is the amount of work that the average horse can do. This is where this number started. This is back in like horse and carriage days, this technology. This number that people are chasing was way before, you know, anything real, anything with real horsepower. But yeah, it's a made up number, and it's calculated off of the torque that you produce, which is the actual measured number.
Right.
And the amount of time. It is torque over time is what horsepower is.
Divided
basically
by 5250.
Yeah, divided by 52. Basically,
whatever.
It is torque over time. And, you know, it's a made-up number. Yeah. I think any tuner that is worth his salt has that same mentality, like, fuck horsepower, you know, after knowing how everything works. Because my buddy Corey, he's the same way. Like, it's a fucking made-up number. Like, you know, don't focus on horsepower. It's not what you really need. You know? And we even do like the horsepower club or whatever, but ultimately we should be doing like 150 foot pound of torque club. That's what we should be doing, you know, cause we're knocking on that door.
Well,
and it's coming, it's going to be the big dogs are going to be 150 plus, you know?
Well, so the thing with horsepower is in our world is the how elusive it is.
Yeah.
Because in these large displacement, large stroke engines. So you take a Harley-Davidson Milwaukee 8, okay, 114 cubic inch motor, right? It is a 4-inch bore. It's not exactly 4 inches, yeah, but it's right around 4 inches.
Close enough.
And a 4.5-inch stroke. So the 4.5-inch stroke means that the piston moves 4.5 inches from top dead center to bottom dead center. You take a Hayabusa, it's a 3-inch.
I wouldn't even know if it was piston. I wouldn't even guess that high. I said 2.5.
And it's a 2.5-inch stroke.
Oh, okay, stroke, yeah.
Yeah, so the stroke is roughly just a little bit more than half. Now, 2.5 inches, you know, you take your finger, and if you take your forefinger, basically, this is like some weird old trick that some old man showed me or I made up. I can't remember. But each pad on your forefinger is roughly 1 inch.
Yeah.
So if you don't have a ruler and you hold your front finger out, it's pretty much 3 inches.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really matter. I mean, even somebody real, yours might be 3.25.
Yeah.
But
pretty much.
Sorry, yeah. Guys.
It's a good
loose your thing, finger's man. 3 inches yeah. long.
Yeah. Well, my Kawasaki was like that. It only had maybe 2.5-inch strokes, so I could rev it out to like 10,000 RPM.
Yeah. So it's really not moving very far.
Yeah.
So the farther things move, the longer it takes for them to travel from point A to point B. So when you talk about like these race bikes that get 12, 14, 16,000 RPMs, it's because the components don't have to move very far. So if you take something that has to move 4.5 inches versus something that moves 2 inches and you spin it 5,000 times per minute, the piece that's moving 5 inches or 4.5 inches is under a extreme amount of stress, where the piece that's moving 2 is under relatively none.
Yeah.
So that's basically how they are able to do this. So, you know, Honda figured all that out. Well, I can't remember his first name, but, you know, he figured that out because he didn't like two-stroke engines because of how dirty they were. And he wanted to make a four-stroke engine that could compete on the Isle of Man, I think it was, right? Back in the, like, 60s, early 60s?
Isle of Man pushed a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you were talking about how, like, everything basically comes to racing. Racing is how we innovate because you don't know what the machines are capable of until you push them to the extreme.
Yeah.
It's the same thing even in, so, rock climbing. I saw that Netflix documentary, the guy that cut his finger off.
I heard you guys talking about it.
Oh, it's crazy. You know, it's super inspiring.
Yeah.
You know, this guy basically picks this unclimbable line on El Capitan in Yosemite and pushes the human to the extreme. Yeah. Well, you don't know what the extreme is until you meet the limit and exceed it, you know? So it's no different. And I think it's part of the human endeavor and the human experience to try to find out what this is. And in that process, you have an extreme amount of R&D and development that goes with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you say that because speaking of Netflix documentaries, the motocross one, Unchained.
Oh, yeah, about the...
That was
isn't that a great awesome one?
And the same kind of thing, you know, you don't realize what's going on.
Behind the scenes.
And, you know, I remember watching all of those X Games and all that stuff that was going on. But like you said, you don't know what your limits are. And as soon as you find out what you think they are, somebody breaks them. And somebody says,
I can do that.
Yeah, Supercross freestyle motocross is a perfect example of that. You know, when they first started, somebody doing a front flip, are you fucking kidding me? That's the dumbest thing you ever said. But they're doing them now.
Well,
you know?
I thought,
And they're doing so many things that...
Well, they're doing them on snowmobiles now.
They do this shit on everything.
I was watching the Winter X Games, and you know, I grew up snowmobiling, and I was like...
I've never been on a snowmobile.
No freaking way. Anyone ever thought of flipping a snowmobile back in the day? And now it's like, well, what else? Now, pretty soon it's going to be razors. Watch.
Oh, yeah. They'll be, yeah.
Because these razors are just, they're insane.
Yeah.
You know, Nick is always talking about just the crazy shit they do.
You know, rollerblade wheeled scooters?
Mm-hmm.
There's like a whole freestyle scooter thing. Like, we're grown-ass men riding these... scooters around, and they do like all these crazy tricks. Like, I've seen this shit, and I mean, they're talented, don't get me wrong, they're doing some crazy shit, but who would have thought fucking scooters. You know what I mean? I guess whatever you can ride around and do flips and tricks on, people don't give a shit anymore. You know, ride it, do it. It's cool, you know? I mean, it's cool. I agree, you know, do what you want to do. But, yeah, I mean, that whole limits thing is great to see people push in anything. You know? Anytime you think that's your limit and you stop, there's something wrong with you. You know what I mean? You always have to find more. I don't think if you're hunting for more, then you're really doing yourself justice. You know?
Well, there's an adage that I think is pretty important, and I think I read it in Neil Donald Walsh's book, and it always stuck with me. And it is: life begins at the edge of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you do things that you know work and it's just always the same thing and you're never pushing the boundaries, you're never going to improve.
Yeah.
I mean, half the time when I'm putting these things together, I don't know what's going to happen. And it scares the shit out of me. You know, people put a lot of money on these things, you know, and I'm like, well,
I think this is going to work.
Yeah. It should work.
Should work. The math's there. I mean, I'm doing my math. I'm using my experience.
I went almost as far last time, and it was okay.
Well, that goes back to the do you know what you're doing question.
No, I don't.
Exactly. And I think we talked about this on the episodes.
I don't know.
Was Jesse James on Monster Garage would ask his contestants, you walk around to them while they're doing shit, hey, you know what you're doing? And he said it was always the same. If the guy said, yeah, I know what I'm doing, he had no fucking clue what he was doing. But if he's like, nope, no idea, he said, I'd turn around and leave him alone because they probably knew exactly what they were doing. And I think that's true. When you get to a point like you're in a niche, something you do well, something you know, even you know you don't know everything. So you know what I mean? Like if you're in doing anything and you think you know you have all the answers, chances are you're delusional.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right. Like, and there's something wrong with that. But being in that position, knowing that, man, I don't know, you know, everything, and something could go wrong at any moment, I think that's what keeps people grounded, and that's the way it should be, you know. When you get better than yourself or what you can provide, then I think everything goes to shit.
Well, and you know, I think you also get, there comes a point, probably in just about any skill set, that it's real difficult to find people to teach you anymore because anyone that could teach you is a competitor.
Yeah, and they don't want to help you.
And they don't want to help you because they're in the same position you're in. Yeah. So the things that they know that you don't know and vice versa, you figure out by basically stalking them.
Trial and error.
You know what I mean? You see things that they do that are working really well, and you're like, well, how is that happening? How are they achieving this? You know, you can call them. They're like,
I mean, unless you're real good friends with them and know somebody, you're probably not going to get what
right.
The answer
so, you want, so but. You, so you have to, you know, there's a lot of studying.
Yeah.
And I think the better you get, the more you have to study, because that's when you realize the things you don't know, because you don't know what you don't know until you go, I just found out I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not like you know, oh, well, I don't know this, I don't know that, I don't know this. No, because if you knew what those were, you would know.
Then you would start researching so that you would start to know, you know? And when you get into racing, performance, all of that, you know, it's kind of like that. And you look at Formula One. I mean, you look at these guys now, these new drivers, they're 20 years old.
Yeah.
And
another great Netflix series.
Oh, Drive to Survive.
Fucking
and on Prime, going back to motorcycles, hitting the apex.
Yeah.
That Brad Pitt did. Oh my gosh.
I think I've watched that, but maybe I need to watch it again.
But the Formula One was cool.
Formula One, NASCAR, things like that have always been very interesting to me because they don't build their own motors. You know what I mean? That kind of Formula One series had a big thing about Renault and Renault, however they say it. I don't know. I say Renault.
Fuck them. They're French.
It's Renault in American.
No, in American, it's gay.
It's Renault. But anyways.
I don't know how they say it in France.
They had the big thing about the one team that went, I think they went to Honda.
Red Bull.
Yeah, they went.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Well, and McLaren the year before was trying to use Honda, but Honda was having a hard time with the turbo setup.
So I would have a hard time not going with Honda, mainly because Honda is so big and has so much R&D in racing in general.
Well, but
they try.
But but
they may not have the best of the best. But to me, they're kind of the go-to. The same with when. So I guess it's probably been 10 years now. I guess since Toyota entered NASCAR. I've always been a big fan of Toyota. I've owned Toyota trucks and cars. They make good stuff.
We're done.
And yeah. But when TRD entered NASCAR, I was really excited because TRD is a serious branch of.
But it Toyota. It took them years.
It did.
It took them years.
Not in the trucks though.
Well, yeah,
the trucks, man, they dialed in, and the drivers were like, "We don't do shit. TRD gives me the truck and I drive it." They killed it in trucks. Now, however that worked out, it is what it is. That's kind of luck of the draw, I think, on a lot of shit, you know. And they had a lot to learn about NASCAR. I think the difference is the rules in NASCAR are almost constantly changing. Every year that shit changes, what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do.
But they do that.
They're very strict.
Try to keep it.
Yeah. And they do to keep it even. I get it. You know, I get it. But
it's bullshit.
The TRD, when they entered, I was like, man, you know, don't get me wrong, buy American. I believe that, you know, but most of those Hondas and Toyotas are assembled.
They are American.
They're fucking assembled here, just like everything else anyways. So, you know, bent out of shape.
I think just
it,
the European cars are still built in Europe.
Yeah.
Which is why there's so much money.
Yeah, Germany.
You know, it's weird if you go to Germany. I don't know if you've ever been to Europe.
I haven't.
If you go to Germany, there's Mercedes and BMW everywhere.
Yeah, they're like,
you know, the cabs and and then like the wealthy drive American cars.
Yeah,
you I've know heard because that it's like the reverse.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of like if you think about it, you're like, oh yeah, I guess that makes sense. You know, with our trade rules and things.
Well, I think honestly, isn't Volkswagen more the Ford? And Mercedes kind of more like the Lincoln or Cadillac, if you will.
I don't know. When I was in Germany, I think every cab I got into was either a BMW or a Mercedes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like the 330.
I love Volkswagen. I mean, I love German cars. Don't get me wrong. I love Volkswagens. I worked for Volkswagen.
Solid
car.
I love that they fucking cheated the EPA for so many years and got away with it.
Dude,
I love
it. Smart as shit, man. Did you ever get like the lowdown on all of this?
Yeah, yes.
So like they had their shit set up. So
you would go and change it.
Yeah, when they do the EPA, they put them on a dyno. So like there were certain parameters that they had set in the computer. So like if the back wheels weren't spinning and the front were.
Or vice versa. Or
it's on a dyno.
Right. So it would switch maps.
And if. There was a couple other variables. I want to say air intake temperature. There was something with intake and something else. I think it might have been map and speed because I think you can tell how fast you're going by the map load and the speed and the intake. But there was something else. There was like three variables. And if it saw all three of those variables, it went into fuck you mode, basically.
Economy mode.
And yeah. And was like, fuck it. We're in EPA testing now. And it knew. Fucking give it to the Germans, dude. That's brilliant. Now, I get it. You know, that it's shitty. But, you know, it is what it is, man. You know, life is made off of people that learn how to work the system properly.
Oh, yeah. We're doing it.
Yeah. Everybody does it. The people that are making money and doing cool shit are. That's how it works.
Well, the unfortunate thing is the rules in general are not there for anything other than to make people wealthy. There's a very small group of people that make money off of the EPA regulations. Because if you tune a vehicle, it's going to run way more efficiently than one out of the factory. If we take the catalyst out of a motorcycle and dyno tune it, when I'm done dyno tuning it, it gets better gas mileage, it runs cleaner, and has less emissions.
Yeah,
and has more performance.
There's still the factor of hydrocarbons.
All the catalyst does is get super fucking hot. And so it's like a blast furnace.
Yeah, it's also the materials in there are a chemical reaction to get rid of some of that
stuff.
Right,
but it just turns it into other compounds that are just as dangerous to the atmosphere.
Oh, I don't disagree.
They just they're looking for carbon monoxide.
The whole thing's shitty.
Yeah, it's the whole thing's a farce and it's a bunch of it's a scam. It's a scam on the people, and what's weird is at some point we're going to have to say, why are we allowing this to happen to us when we're the ones that are supposed to be making the rules?
Well, it starts with the cars, and cars rule the road. And I get it, you know, the EU LEV and LEV and all that shit. The low emissions vehicles, if you will. I get it. There's so many cars on the road. Motorcycles don't take up nearly the percentage of, you know, emissions and things like that.
But even the cars, though.
To be as hard on them as you are on the cars is kind of rough, you know. Because, let's face it, I mean, let's say for the sake of argument, we have 1,000 regular customers, okay? These are customers that don't go anywhere else. They only come to us. They buy our bikes from us. They only come to us. 500 of those customers, I'm going to say, ride 5,000 miles or less a year.
Probably 700.
Okay, yeah.
700 out of 1,000.
We'll say, you know, another 210,000 or less a year. And you're getting down to, I would say, out of 1,000 customers, 50 maybe ride more than 20 to 25,000 miles a year, more.
I think you're being very generous with your statistics.
Out of 1,000 customers.
Out of 1,000 customers, I think you're being really generous. How, you know how many 2017 motorcycles I've seen do a 25K?
Yeah, but I mean, I have a customer that has an 18 that we've done a 35 on just recently. Yeah.
One guy.
And I mean, I don't know what you would factor in how many regular customers we have, maybe 1,000. I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm just shooting out there.
Right, but you're like, wow. Yeah,
but
wow. There
are guys, you know,
it's so rare
I
you remember it.
A half a dozen guys or so in my last dealership that would ride more than 20,000 miles a year, probably more than that.
But that's
more
like
30, maybe.
But I would say that's out of every customer in your dealership, you had a half a dozen.
Yeah.
You probably have more than 1,000 customers.
So for the most part, most people that are buying bikes just really aren't, you know, riding them as much as they should be. We'll say that. And I think a lot of that has to do with obviously working and time and things like that. People buy them, they don't have time, but.
Well, that and they're recreational vehicles.
Well, they are, and that's what I mean. And that was kind of what I was getting at, is that should they have the same, you know, EPA restrictions when 50 to 70%, we agree, 50% to 70% of them that are sold never get the kind of mileage that are going to make a difference. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So why do they crack so hard on like Harley and Honda and all of them? They all have to meet the requirements. You know, it's not like Harley is singled out by any means. But for a recreational vehicle, should it be so stringent? You know, Harley could put out bikes that sound and run a lot better than they do if it wasn't for all the restrictions that were put on them. Do they have to be like the asshole next door with straight pipes? No. But they can sound better, you know. Even the Screaming Eagle pipes that they put out, you know, sound better.
Well, part of the EPA compliance is decibel level.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
I mean,
yeah.
even back when they first came out with the twin cams, even the engine itself has to fall below a certain decibel level of output.
Well, yeah, it's like overall and like passing by at like 3,000 RPMs or something.
Yeah, the parameters are ridiculous.
Yeah, so that was and this is what they told me in Milwaukee, was that was a lot of the drive to quiet down the motor so that they could open up the exhaust a little bit, which kind of happened in the liquid cooled motors, but nobody really noticed. They were trying to quiet down the motor, and when they went to the Milwaukee 8, it was supposed to quiet down quite a bit, and they're a little bit louder, but you don't notice because the motor's so fucking quiet. So the whole thing ends up quieter. But that was their aim, was to quiet down the motor so they could open up the exhaust. But nobody believes that. If you talk to anybody that listens to a Milwaukee 8, no one would agree with that because they don't seem louder at all. But it's a good platform.
In 1999, they said exactly the same thing about the twin cam.
But it was quieter, and they were
that it didn't sound like a Harley. These are
these are
bullshit. Now they got Porsche involved. Blah blah blah. It's never the thing that sucks about the Harley Davidson customer or rider is that they bash their own product so badly, nobody else really needs to get on the platform. They can just stand and listen to the Harley riders bash the Harleys.
So I saw a fucking meme the other day, and it was like a dude with a purse and like some Daisy Dukes on, and it said new Softail, and then it was like a hot chick, and then it said like Dinah, and I was like, you obviously own a Dinah.
Right.
Because if you owned a Milwaukee 8 Softail, you would talk shit to everybody that fucking rode a Dyna because your bike's better than theirs.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
So we had a customer. This is really good. We had a customer in today, has a Heritage, one of your favorites. He loves it. He's in a band, this and that, and he loves the bike. And he's like, yeah, you know, maybe next year I'm going to trade up to like a Road Glide and do like a big motor build. And me and Sam are like, why? And he's like, well, you know, it'd be really cool to have a big motor and all that shit. And we're like, do you like your Heritage? And he's like, yeah, I love this bike. We're like, it's the same motor. Like, we could do big motor build in your Heritage and now, say, fuck the Road Glide. And he was like, I never really thought about it.
Yeah, and we could put bags on it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I fucking hate the Milwaukee 8. Heritage. I don't love it. I hate it because I hate Heritage Softails. I have my whole life.
Yeah.
And the Milwaukee 8 Heritage Softail rides so good.
Yeah.
It handles so well that when I get on one, I don't want to stop riding it, and it pisses me the fuck off because I hate the way they look.
So this is where I truly believe Harley went wrong with the new Softail. First off, fuck all the old names.
Yeah, they should have just...
To me, a Heritage Softail is two-tone paint, chrome everything, and white walls.
And fringy bags.
Yeah, fringy bags. Yeah, exactly.
Fringe leather bags.
Windshield, you know, but chrome everything,
mm-hmm.
two-tone paint, white walls. That's a Heritage. Not a single Heritage is made that way now. Not a single one. So they're not Heritages. You know, call it something else. I like it. I love the bike. Don't get me wrong. Just don't call it a Heritage. It's not a Heritage. Let's not call it a Fat Bob, okay? Because a Fat Bob was a Dyna. Shut everybody the fuck up about it. Let's not give them anything to talk about. Let's call it something else. You know what I mean? Why did they have to stick with the names? I think this is their holding on to the old mentality that's going to hurt them. I think what is going to help them is their new mentality in buying Stasic, in pumping up the electric bikes, and everything that they're doing that is outside of what they would normally do is right.
Well,
and I think that I understand sticking with the names for nostalgic reasons, but they are not the same platform.
They're not.
To go from a Dyna to a Softail platform completely changes it. So shut everybody up about it and just name it something else. Name it something fucking cool. I don't give a shit what you name it.
Well, so I agree with that. And I hopefully that's happening in the Sportster realm.
Oh, yeah.
Because
I love my Sporty, but bye-bye Sporty. You got to get rid of that thing.
I hope
It's too expensive.
These new liquid cooled V twin
1250s
that are coming out are going to replace the Sportster. And I'm with you. I love Sportsters. They can make
like a Revolution 1250.
Well, supposedly that's what's coming out, yeah, and it's a multi-platform.
Right. And
yeah.
They can make nasty bikes that would fuck everybody up.
So here's what they need to do though. We have to embrace that. The dealership level has to embrace it.
Oh yeah.
Because
they just need to give me a dual sport.
It's what killed the V-Rod.
Yeah.
They did not. The problem is when there's a huge disconnect, and maybe it's because the dealerships are franchise. You know, the engineers don't seem to know what at the ground level the trend is coming towards.
Well, I think you said that they weren't selling it properly. And I think that you get in being independently owned dealerships and things like that across the country, you get a lot of people that are stuck in the older mentality, like you said. And Harley cannot make people change their minds on things.
Right.
So, you know, like you said, the live wire is going to be interesting to see how people accept that and try to sell it. You know what I mean? Because
at the dealerships. Level. Yeah. Because, you know, here Harley introduces this revolutionary bike.
It's amazing.
Well, right. Yeah, but the amount of backlash is phenomenal, equal to the amount of acceptance. And like they come out with these new Softails, they do away with the Dyna, right?
Yeah.
It's the right move.
It was.
Absolutely the right move. Yeah, it is a fantastic platform.
Yeah.
They really scored. But just as many people are pissed about it because, and these people never, they haven't ridden them. They're stuck in the old ways. So you have these people that say Harley needs to come up with something new. As soon as Harley comes up with something new, they say, this is bullshit. What did you do this for? Yeah. Like you wanted something new. Yeah, but it wasn't this. Well, what do you want?
Yeah.
You want, well, I want the Dyna back. Well, that's not new.
Yeah.
The Dyna is old news.
FXR back is what they want.
Fuck FXRs.
Yeah, I know.
You know, if those were, those are the best motorcycles Harley made. That's why they only made it for, 8 years? They've made the Sportster the first.
Do you know how heavy those frames are?
Dude, FXRs are a fucking pain in the ass all the way around. And
they're cool looking, don't get me wrong. And yeah, they're a bike you can beat on. They have a very strong frame. You can beat on them.
You can beat on all Harleys. We've seen
do
it.
Do you really
We've
think
done
the
it.
Diner, the Diner, the Diner. Dyna is a lot weaker? That they brought out after?
Well, I see a hell of a lot more guys wheeling Dynas than I do FXRs.
That's what I was
going to
say. I mean, do you really think they went, well, yeah, this FXR is awesome, but fuck it. Let's go back a little bit and we'll just do this. No. They took what they learned from the FXR and from the touring bikes and from the XL, and they created the Dyna. And the Dyna was supposed to be the best of both worlds. Now everybody loves them. You know, you couldn't sell one for years. I swear to God, it was hard to sell Dynas.
Still can't sell them.
Nobody wanted them. You know, when you think of a Harley Davidson, depending on your age and where you're at, you either think of a full bagger or a Heritage Softail.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah. Or,
those
or
are
a Sportster.
The classic Harley.
Or a Sportster.
Yeah. Sportster, yeah, but for the most part, I would think if you were to put two bikes out there without labeling on them and have the most people grab them as Harleys, it would be a full dresser and a Heritage Softail.
And you know why?
Because you could put a Yamaha Bolt up there and people would say it was a Sportster.
Yeah, but you know with the Heritage, and well, probably both those bikes, you know why? Because here's one thing that Harley Davidson has excelled at. They look so close to the way they looked 50 years ago,
yeah,
that the iconic image has maintained. And that I think is probably why Harley Davidson is as prolific as it is, because they've done a phenomenal job of being in the company's own terms, an evolutionary company, not a revolutionary company.
And that's
now they're becoming revolutionary because they have no choice.
Well, they have to, yeah.
We have no choice anymore.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think it's fantastic.
Well, for the most part, that's like kind of my argument. Same on the same side with the Heritage is, if they did two-tone paint, chrome, everything, and white walls, you could park one next to one 50 years ago and go, wow, that's a new model of that, and that is right. Fucking cool. Yeah, it's got these funky-ass lights on it. Yeah, everything's not shaped exactly the same. But when you pull one up next to it that's all blacked out and has some chrome stuff and you park it next to it, you're like, yeah, I see it. Some of the very early ones were kind of blacked out anyways. But I think for the most part, they kind of missed.
Yeah, they did the Slims. That was kind of a variation of the.
Yeah, and the Slim's always been a soft tail.
Right, but I mean, it was like that bad boy Heritage.
Yeah,
the Slim was when everything was getting fat tires.
Or what about the Rocker? you always got to bring up the Rocker.
And you know another terrible bike that they make right now is the Fat Boy. It's a neat looking motorcycle. It handles like shit.
It's a V rod, dude. No. If you put that thing on the drag strip, it would fucking probably.
No, it wouldn't. The fucking back tire weighs more than a V rod.
It's the same tire, isn't it?
Yeah, without all the horsepower.
Yeah, well, that depends on your Fat Boy,
dude. The Fat Boy, you know, we've got. If you're listening, Joe, I apologize. That motorcycle is terrible for everyday riding. And I mean,
well, yeah, but he didn't want it for that anyways.
No, he wants it to go fast as shit, and that's what we're doing for him. And
that's a bike that'll hold the road well and hold him well.
But I don't know why. I understand the predicament that companies get into, because if you look at even like Chevrolet and Ford, they're in the same predicament. Okay, Chevrolet is coming out with a new Blazer. It's going to look nothing like a Blazer. It's going to be terrible, just like the Nova. When they brought the Nova back out, you're like, what in the shit is that? That's not a Chevrolet Nova. Well, just for a short time, and then it didn't sell. Because it was like the Malibu. So Ford is bringing back the Bronco. And from everything I've heard, it's going to be a square body truck frame.
It looks cool.
Fucking full size Bronco. Well, Chevrolet, if you're going to bring back the Blazer, you need to bring back a Blazer, not the Equinox with a different tag on it.
I guess Ford had the Bronco too.
Which was the emission compliant.
I had a Bronco too on like 35s with like 6 inches of lift. Fucking love that truck. It was absolutely horrible inside of it though. All red interior. It made me want to throw up. But it was mint. I mean, it was like the day it was fucking bought. It was so amazing. And this thing was like a burgundy and silver two-tone Bronco 2, 35-inch tires. Like I said, 6.5-inch Rancho suspension. It was done up. Really nice. Really nice truck. And I'd got it from my uncle. It had 35 1550s on it. Okay. They fucking looked. It looked mean. It looked really mean. But they were like kind of highway tread tires. They weren't mud tires. You know what I mean? So it looked big, and it was an everyday driver. I didn't realize, but I'd worn the tires out. My uncle had an F-150 with 35 1250s on it, but they were like all-terrains. They weren't quite as wide, but they were all-terrain, good-looking tire. He was putting bigger on his truck, so he's like, hey, do you want these tires? Yes, I do. You know, the price is right. So I put him on the truck. Wow, 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 everywhere you go. I sold it 2 weeks later. I could not stand it. And it might not have been 2 weeks, it might have been a month. But I think I drove it around for 2 weeks and I had a date and I took this chick out. I don't even remember who. But I remember,
couldn't even talk to her.
That was my problem. We go out and I'm like, yeah, so blah, 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 like yelling at her in the truck. And I was like, oh, this is not going to work. You know? So I ended up selling it right after I buried it in the mud. So funny story. I was it was Sunday morning and I showed up to work at 9 o'clock like it was every other day. And I didn't have my cell phone. This is years ago. So I didn't have my cell phone or anything, and I was like, fuck, I got like 2.5 hours until I got to be to work. You know, we didn't open until like 11:30, whatever it was. So I take this Bronco out and I'm dicking around and there's a dried up lake bed. I'm like, oh, cool. Ooh, you know, go screw around in the lake bed. And, you know, as it dries up, there's always like the last little bit. Well, it was dried up as well. But you could tell, yeah, on the top, you could tell that what was mud and what wasn't. And I knew better. So I see it, and there's like two tracks where somebody in a truck went through it. You know, might as well be a goddamn invitation. Like, hey, come drive through me. So, of course, you don't just put it in four-wheel drive because that's how dumbasses, you know, do it. So I put it in two-wheel drive, run into this thing, and get like halfway through it and bury the rear axles. I'm like, shit. All right. So I'd already locked the hubs, you know, put it in four-wheel drive, back out. I'm going to make this because I'm a fucking idiot. So I give it hell. I get back in it. I bury the rear axle again. This time, put it in four-wheel drive, go to put it in reverse. The front axle gets buried. And I'm like, shit. And I work this thing back and forth for at least 5 minutes. And, you know, all that does is bury you more more and more. No cell phone. I'm in the middle of a lake in a fucking neighborhood in Lake Mary, Florida. And I'm like, you gotta be fucking shitting me. So I walked like 2 miles to a gas station, called my buddy. And, you know, it's all Ford Chevy. Everything's Ford Chevy. Of course, I'm driving a Ford. So I call my buddy. He's got a Chevy. I'm like, hey, I'm stuck in the mud. I need some help. And he's like, oh, motherfucker. You know, it starts. The Chevy Ford thing starts.
Of course you're stuck.
You know, oh, you're fucking Ford. You should have bought a goddamn Chevy. And, you know, I have to eat my humble pie because I'm stuck in the mud. And I'm like, you know, yeah, man. Yeah, I bought a Ford. Come pull me out, please. So he shows up, Z71, jacked all up. We hook up the fucking thing. He hits the button on his electronic four-wheel drive. Nothing. So now he can't pull me out because he doesn't have four-wheel drive. Because
he has a Chevy.
Because he has a Chevy, yeah. So now it really starts, and I'm like, oh, yeah, you're talking shit about my Ford, but here it is, time for the real deal, and your Chevy ain't got shit. At least my Ford's spinning all four wheels in the mud, you know. So we call another guy, shows up with a Chevy. I don't remember exactly what happened with him, but he could not get me out either. So now it's, you know, Ford -1, Chevy -2. And it took another Ford to get me out, of course, because the only thing that can pull a Ford out of the mud is a Ford. And sure enough, you know, I got my buddy. He had a big-ass Ford. He came out and yanked me out like I was a piece of trash. And then, you know, pulled the other Chevys out because they were trash, too. But, yeah, you know, the Bronco 2, the Blazer, they did the S10, the mid-range, but the S10 Blazer was always like a mom's car.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was never... The Bronco 2 was cool. Those, like, windows that rolled up the sides, like, that was shit you wanted to take out in the fucking, you know, the Safari or whatever, because it was cool. The Blazer was never really given that same thing. Not the S10 Blazer. You know, the big Blazer was always badass, but the little Blazers, not so much. So, but I don't know, man. I think we kind of gone a little off topic here. We're talking
Ford and Chevy,
yeah, Ford
on a
Chevy
motorcycle.
Cars, yeah, on the motorcycle podcast. But hey, that's how it goes.
Well, but you know, the topic, just the R&D that the companies go through. I mean, some, yeah. you don't really know what to do. I don't think these guys really know.
That's what racing is, man. That, you know, that's why we're on the racing topic. They don't know shit, man. They're like, hey, how do we get more horsepower without changing the restrictor plate, without doing this, without doing that? And that's how they get into weird shit, into weird porting, into what was it Aaron said, like freezing fuel lines,
freezing your fuel lines.
Yeah, like who the fuck would have thought of that? Smart idea. You know, you cool the fuel down. I guess it atomizes better. It's denser. however that works. I don't know. I'm sure there's
a like, lot of science. Well, like, you know, there, Ferrari, in Formula One, they did that with the airports that run through the cars.
Yeah.
So they had a hole in the cockpit. And when they would go into corners, they would take their hand off the hole and they would go into corners and it would pull the air through the cockpit of the car and help pull the car to the ground.
Oh.
And then when they would hit the straightaways, they would take their hand off the wheel and pop right on the side of the cockpit. Because, you know, those cockpits are designed around the driver. So yeah. It's not like they have to move very far.
Yeah.
So when they're trying to make maximum speed, they cover this little hole and everybody else says, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
So what it did was it changed the aerodynamic flow and lifted the back of the car.
Yeah.
As the air bypassed the cockpit.
Like a vacuum inside or something.
Yeah, so when they pull their hand off the cockpit, the air would create a vacuum and suck the cockpit and the back of the car down. When they cover the hole, it would lift it off the ground. I mean, you're talking like maybe a half of an inch, but at 190 miles an hour, a half of an inch can make 194 miles an hour.
So do you remember the 300 ZX twin turbo early mid 90s was like a really hot car? Well, I had a friend who bought one. And if you took one of those cars and like sat it still and just turned the wheel all the way to the left, let's see, it would... The left rear corner would drop like an inch, and you could see it sitting still. It did it. It did it even sitting still. And then if you went to the right, it would lift back up, and the right side would drop to an inch. And the idea was the roll in a turn. You know, when you start turning right, and that car wants to roll to the left, it would drop that suspension down to level out the car. Mm-hmm. And my buddy had bought one. He's like, "Oh yeah, this is cool." I was like, "Yeah, you want to see something cool?" And I showed him that, and he was like, "What? I didn't even know that." And I was like, yeah, these things are pretty badass. And they were cool cars. But yeah, you know, there's so much technology. Where do you think that came from? Racing.
Racing.
Yeah. Like they didn't just do that. That shit came out of probably Formula One, or I don't know if Nissan does Formula One, but came out of some kind of racing. So, but I don't know, man. I think we've wrapped up some time here. I think I can hear the stuff.
The exit?
Yeah, I was trying to see.
Well, I think what, you know, Harley really screwed up with the 750, the GS or SGs or whatever the
fuck. XG?
XG, yeah. I don't even know the goddamn nomenclature of... Stupid things.
Yeah, it's underpowered.
The streets.
It's underpowered and overweight.
Well, you know, if they're gonna design those to be low, to be what they are, they should not have made a racing class with them. Yeah. If they're going to make a racing class with them, then they should open it up for racing parts and not piss off their long term partners like SNS and all these companies that's what they do. It feels like the company has gotten away from its heritage and they're moving into, out of desperation, they're moving away from the things that are going to help it in the future.
Well, did you see, so I can hear the guitar going.
I can too.
They got into surfing. Did you see this?
No.
Harley Davidson is sponsoring like a bunch of world events. Said that surfers are 400 and something percent more likely to have ridden a motorcycle than anybody else. And like 200 and something percent more likely to buy a motorcycle in the next year or two. So.
Where the fuck are they getting their statistics?
I don't know, man. But it's pretty crazy.
They should give a bunch of them away and have them spray paint them.
Yeah. So, Harley and surfing. Wrap your head around that.